From Michigan Radio, this is State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer White. Nearly one in four kids lives in poverty in Michigan. Over the past year, we've been looking at what it takes to make Michigan a place where those kids can get ahead. But part of that examination has to take place in the face of equity. Are things equal for all kids, and does it matter? We want to hear from you. Have your experiences led you to believe that everyone has an equal shot at achieving the American dream, or does inequity exist? Call us at 866-255-2762, or you can find us on Facebook. Just search for State of Opportunity. You can also send us a tweet at State of Op. That's with two P's. Joining us now is Doak Bloss, Health Equity and Social Justice Coordinator at the Ingham County Health Department. Doak, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
In our State of Opportunity project, we talk a lot about disparities that exist for children in low-income families. But what's the difference between disparity and inequity?
Well, basically, if you think of disparity being a difference in a statistic, basically, between one population and another, let's say infant mortality, for example, or rates of cancer, rates of diabetes, for a population like African Americans is much higher in my county and across Michigan than it is for white people. So if you just look at the disparity, basically you're saying there's a difference, and you're not really exploring the reasons why that exists, difference exists. Equity and inequity basically asks us to try to figure out what underlying conditions are creating that problem. One way to think of it is if you imagine two people on separate ladders trying to get somewhere, and one is doing better than the other, one is higher up. But then you look at the ladder and you notice that that person's rungs has a lot more rungs, has a lot more, it's easier to climb the ladder. For the person on the other side, it's very difficult. In fact, sometimes you have to hang on for dear life to just stay on the ladder and can't get ahead. That's inequity, and those are the things that we try to deal with in our work.
I think when people think about inequity, sometimes they think about it in the same grouping as discrimination, but those are different things.
Yes. Discrimination, they're related, certainly. Discrimination would be treatment of someone either at the interpersonal level or the institutional level, treating someone as less than. If it were at the interpersonal level, I might in subtle ways or unconscious ways, I might act in a way that was diminishing to, let's say, if we're talking about gender, to a woman or in race, a person of color, as a white person, I might treat them in some way that was, diminishing in some way. Can't think of the right word exactly, but at the institutional level, when that becomes a practice of an organization to do that, or it becomes there are unwritten policies that actually influence who gets ahead and who doesn't, that's also a form of discrimination.
We're working through these definitions. Can you give us a concrete example of how inequity could play out in a structure?
Let's say we operate health centers, right? We also operate a lot of clinics for WIC and other types of programs. Let's just imagine a simple example of, let's say a person at the front office opens their window all the way for a white person who comes to the window, but only like a few inches for an African American, which sends a message that they're not trusted in some way. And that would be an interpersonal thing unless that's sanctioned by the organization, then it's an institutional type of treating as less than. And I have to say, I mean, we're going to get to privilege in just a minute. It's hard not to go there right away. As a person who's white and male, you know, I don't see all the ways in which I am given privileges in my daily life. An African American walking beside me through my day would probably see 12 instances of it automatically. Things that come to me automatically because I'm white and male that wouldn't come to a person of color or a woman.
Well, since we're there, let's go on and talk about privilege, because that is part of this discussion, and you've done a lot of work around what you call unearned privilege. Mm-hmm. What is it?
It's basically an advantage that's given to a person based on one aspect of their identity. And it could be any number of things. In fact, I would say probably all in our lifetime experience unearned privilege, but we don't see it because we just assume that what the conditions for us are the same for everybody else. So based on race, based on gender, on socioeconomic status or class, sexual orientation, age, youth, language of origin, all of these things could be an area where one might experience unearned privileges if they're in what we call the non-target group status. So a white person or a man or a heterosexual or a person whose first language is English. And we don't, because we don't see them because it's just the world we live in. If you don't get those privileges, then you see them very easily. For instance, as a gay man, I will see, you know, the privileges that heterosexuals will receive automatically because I just see it, you know, all the things that come to a heterosexual that don't to me. But as a white person, I have to work to see it. You know, I have to work to realize that, oh, I'm not being followed in the store because of the color of my skin. You know, why would I be?
But what you're describing is something very fluid.
Exactly.
Everyone can experience a degree of privilege.
And in the workshops we do, that's an important concept to get to, which is because generally it's very easy to see where you are oppressed or you're discriminated against in some way or prejudice is applied against you. It's not so easy to see where you have privilege. So if we look across many different types of those and how they intersect with each other, then it becomes possible to see, oh, I did, even though I worked really hard all my life, I realize now that someone else who's different from me would have had to work 10 times harder to get to the same place.
Mm. We're talking to Doug Bloss, Health Equity and Social Justice Coordinator at the Ingham County Health Department. Let's take a call from Patrick in Holland. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I went to public schools in West Michigan, and I was raised by an upper-class family and had the opportunity to attend an Ivy League university. And I very much believe that having that opportunity was a result of the support and coaching I received from my parents. And certainly the money was a big part as well. But I do think that the encouragement and just knowing about these types of places is a real advantage that maybe some people might not consider.
Patrick, were you always aware that you had certain advantages, or did that awareness come at a later point in life?
No, I was pretty much immediately aware as a young child.
And how does that affect, do you have conversations with other people in your life where you have that sort of knowledge about yourself, but you find that other people don't see it quite as clearly?
I do think that it helps me understand people around me and to understand why a bright student would not go to a similar institution. It's or certainly some of the people in lower socioeconomic environments. You know, if you don't have the people around you to support you and just to even inform you of these opportunities, how can you ever take advantage of them?
Patrick, thanks so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you.
So, Doak, here's someone who sees his mm-hmm. privilege fairly clearly. Mm-hmm. In the sessions you do in Ingham County, do you have that experience often, that people have that kind of visibility of the privilege in their lives?
I have a whole range of experiences. In contrast to Patrick's story, we would have quite often someone who was not doing well off socioeconomically but who was white, who would react immediately on the first day to the notion that they have unearned privilege very negatively because they worked really hard. They had to fight to get where they are. So it's a very hard thing to see in that situation. What I like about Patrick's what he brought out there, that I think there was some recent studies showing that so many people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, regardless of race, don't even think about the possibility of going to places where they might actually have some advantage, get some financial aid. So it's a very difficult thing, and it's why our workshops last 4 days. We have 2 days, then a week off, and then 2 more days. So people think about these things for a while before they come to an understanding of what we're talking about. Hopefully, once they do begin to see their privilege, they can't not see it in the future. And so that can help them empathize and also help them notice when they might be practicing inequity or prejudice in some way in their work.
This is State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. You can join the conversation at 866-255-2762. You can leave us a question on our State of Opportunity Facebook page or tweet us at State of Op. That's OPP. Doak, I want to get back into this idea of the fluidity of privilege mm-hmm. and how it's attached to equity. Because if we all can experience privilege, how do those two things work together?
One of the most important things about this troubling concept of unearned privilege is that it feels bad when you first realize you may have it. And there isn't really a good reason for why it should feel bad. In fact, we often tell people, you didn't create this situation. You didn't create this. And so you're not responsible for it. You're responsible for acknowledging it, that you get it, perhaps. And often people think, well, okay, once I've realized this, what do I do with it? Am I supposed to give it away? You know, and you're always, you can't. I mean, you cannot, as Peggy McIntosh has said more recently, it's like a bank account that you can write as many checks as you want on, and you're still going to have it. So what do you do with it? I mean, one of the biggest revelations for me personally in doing this work a few years ago was I always thought that my job in doing this work was to understand what it's like to be a person of color or a woman, someone who experiences this daily experience of racism or sexism. And then I realized I couldn't. It is absolutely not possible. My work is to figure out what it means to be white, to understand that. And then, once I get there, not give my privilege away, but use it. Because one of these things about working across differences, different types of differences, is if I speak about racism, white people hear me differently from if one of my African-American fellow facilitators speaks about it. It's heard as you're asking for something for yourself, and it's just not heard. If I speak about heterosexism, straight people think of me asking for something for myself, but if my African-American straight colleague talks about it, they hear it very differently. So, I mean, this work has to be about us marching forward together to overcome and recognize this privilege that we have.
So once you have that knowledge, once you go about the work of understanding your position, how do we deal with the issue of inequity if it's so ingrained in the way our society functions? What do we do?
Well, that's often, we talk about the bubble in the wallpaper that we keep moving around, the hope that we can actually do something about this, because it feels terribly overwhelming when you first get into it. What can I possibly do about that? At the interpersonal level, we certainly can track what we're doing and what's happening in our minds and our values. And at the institutional level, we can challenge every single policy decision we make. We can question whether this is going to inequitably affect certain members of our community.
You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. Doak Bloss is Health Equity and Social Justice Coordinator at the Ingham County Health Department. Doak, thanks for joining us. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I'm Jen White. Structural disparities and inequity exist, but how do they affect individuals and families who are trying to break the cycle of poverty? You can join the conversation at 866-255-2762 or send us a message at the State of Opportunity Facebook page. You can also send us a tweet at State of Op, that's with two P's. Joining us now are Aaron Currier, Director of the Economic Mobility Project at Pew Charitable Trusts, and Linwood Cousins, Director and Professor at the School of Social Work at Western Michigan University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron, I'd like to start with you. What does economic mobility look like in America today?
Our project at Pew is investigating economic mobility and how families move up and down the economic ladder over their lifetimes and across generations. And what our research shows is a pretty mixed view. On the one hand, we know that the vast majority of adults today have higher family incomes than their parents did at the same age, and that's true across the income distribution. But at the same time, the extent of those income gains is not always enough to move someone to a different rank on the income ladder as a whole. And we see this stickiness at the ends, which means people who were raised in the bottom are highly likely to remain in the bottom themselves as adults, and people who were raised at the top are pretty likely to stay at the top.
Aaron, is this a new picture, or has the country looked this way for some time?
Well, we don't actually know. The research that we have conducted is based on longitudinal data that's actually developed and housed at the University of Michigan. It's called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics, and it follows real families over time. It was started in 1968 with a subset of American families, and now we are looking at the outcomes for those families' children. So because of the limitations of the data, we don't really know about, for example, the grandparents' generation, and the children of today's adults are still too young.
Linwood, has Michigan become a place where economic mobility is more limited?
Reportedly, that's the case if you follow what has been occurring with the auto industry and the industries that are offshoots of that. Those things are sort of played out in the newspapers every day, I believe, that that they have had an effect on mobility. But, you know, we are reportedly in a period of recovery, except that that happens much slower or at a slower pace for those at the bottom of the economic ladder, those who perhaps are most in need of moving up.
Aaron, we can talk about economic mobility, but make the distinction for us between income and wealth.
Sure, that's a great question. When we define income, we mean it as the total income derived from anything that's taxable income. So earnings, the interest, dividends, and any cash transfers like Social Security. Wealth, on the other hand, is an estimate of all things that a person or a family has to draw on. So their home equity, their farm or their business, their checking and their savings accounts, minus any debts.
So in the picture that you're painting, that wealth gap in the U.S. has grown significantly.
Sure. We see that the income gap and the wealth gap have grown significantly, though it is very interesting to distinguish between income and wealth in one particular sense. When we look at the way that the income distribution has changed over the last generation, we can see a widening out for each of the rungs of the ladder, so to speak. So the thresholds that define what is the bottom fifth and the second fifth, those have actually gotten larger over time when you look at income. When you look at wealth, the same is not true. The wealth distribution has actually compressed for the middle and the bottom over the last generation, while it has widened out at the top.
Hmm. Linwood, when we talk about economic mobility, how does that impact communities where there are high concentrations of poverty?
First and foremost, it limits their ability to move or to be mobile in accessing opportunities that may change their circumstance. And that means both their ability to increase their income, their ability to improve the educational opportunities for their children in terms of the quality of schools. And beyond that, the overall quality of life, accessing health care, the taken-for-granted kinds of things that families and children do in neighborhoods and communities in terms of their social and recreational lives. All of those things are quite challenged in communities of concentrated poverty. So the ability to be mobile and to have opportunities to move beyond that have been followed quite closely by social scientists. And although there isn't total agreement on the extent to which personal effects versus what we would call neighborhood effects or community effects are the most powerful, it's clear that in many circumstances when a low-income family or a family that's living in concentrated poverty is able to move to a community that is at higher on the economic ladder, both in terms of social characteristics and in terms of economic characteristics, the quality of their lives improves.
We're speaking with Linwood Cousins, professor at Western Michigan University, and Aaron Currier of Pew Charitable Trusts. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you experienced a sudden change in wealth or income? Did that change the way you saw the world or the way you felt the world saw you? Call us at 866-255-2762 or send us a tweet at State of Op. Aaron, we've been talking about inequity and privilege. Is there a connection between that economic mobility and inequity?
Well, so that's a great question, and it draws a distinction here between how we define those things. So income inequality really looks at the difference between the richest Americans and the poorest Americans, how wide that spread is, whereas economic mobility looks not at the distance between the richest and the poorest Americans, but at their ability to actually navigate up and down that income ladder over their lifetimes. It's this question of, you know, if the richest Americans are 1,000 times richer than the poorest Americans or 1,000,000 times richer than the poorest Americans, that may not matter if they are actually able to change positions on the income ladder, and anyone has equal opportunity to meet that top slot. So we look at their opportunities to actually make it into the top or make it into the middle, or to fall down, because in order for someone to move up, someone else has to fall down. What we see is that regardless of how wide the income distribution is, those who start at the bottom do not right now have an equal chance of rising.
So what does that mean? We have 1 in 4 kids living in Michigan in poverty. Linwood, when you hear that, what are the chances for those kids?
Given the data, not very positive. I mean, what we are talking about then is the transmission of intergenerational poverty, that these children will likely not do much better than their parents. And that challenges me, the notion of democracy and the notion of a system, of a culture, of a nation that embraces not only opportunity for individuals, but for disadvantaged groups. And given the wealth that we have, it questions whether or not we're willing to share it. We get dogged in these debates about whether or not people who are poor, and consequently if their families, their children, whether or not they've caused their circumstances because of poor decisions or because of issues of we might consider morality and character. But at the end of the day, we're all people, we're all vulnerable to decisions that will negatively affect us. But to conclude that because of a person's station in life based on the accident of birth, that that is to say that they're born into a poor family in a concentrated, impoverished neighborhood, that somehow that means they shouldn't get a helping hand, that's troubling. And so, I'm playing around with two things here. On the one hand, that yes, these children, they face challenging odds in moving out of their circumstance, but I think we have quite a bit of opportunities to help change that. And so the conclusion doesn't have to be a fixed one.
Let's invite Leah in Ann Arbor into the conversation. Leah, thanks for joining us. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. My comment is, so I'm someone who grew up in poverty, the child of a mother who did not finish high school, and she grew up in abject poverty, the oldest of 10. I went on to not only finish high school and undergrad, but get a master's and then a PhD at U of M. And it's just really, really interesting what you're saying about intergenerational poverty and how pervasive it is, because I looked at the rest of my family, and they're really sort of living paycheck to paycheck. My mom still lives in a trailer, struggles financially, and it's not through any character flaw. It's that there are such differences in forms of capital, whether they're social, cultural, economic, and it's just so incredibly pervasive. And when I look at the research around, because my field is education, and I think, how did I make it out of that cycle? It's just amazing to me, and it's just so pervasive. And I think that we're becoming more comfortable, I see, in education talking about privilege based on ethnicity and culture, but less so related to class. It's like somehow that's the thing we don't want to talk about in America.
Leah, what do you think made the difference for you?
I think that the big difference for me was my mother rented a home. We moved to a neighborhood that was not a high-poverty neighborhood. So we were in kind of a grungy area. We rented a home, but my friends in junior high and high school had parents who were college-educated, and there was a great deal of academic press, I felt, just for my friends. And I think that I started to see myself as someone who could go to college, that could be a possibility for me. And, I think about, I do a lot of work with schools in Detroit now, and I think about what's it like for kids who grew up, like I grew up in poverty, but don't have friends that let them sort of see a different possibility. And also I got a good education. I went to a good school district, even though I was very poor. So I think those things made a difference.
Leah, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
So, Linwood, does this speak a bit to that issue of what we see in neighborhoods where there's concentrated poverty? It sounds like Leah had the opportunity to see other options for her life.
Yes, she sort of hit the nail on the head, so to speak, that whether she was conscious of it or not, what we tend to know is that neighborhoods have opportunities, they have levels of and types of socialization toward college attendance and other behaviors that that are both consciously and unconsciously internalized by residents and by children. And we can't take that for granted. I mean, these things aren't always visible, but you could line up numerous people and you would hear similar stories as the caller in terms of the effects of their community, whether they are aware of them or not, or I could recite for them in looking at issues of mobility and the difference between what happens in terms of socialization in a concentrated poverty community versus a middle to higher income community. The differences would be stark, and they've been well documented.
Aaron, Leah also hit upon this issue of the stickiness of poverty, and you alluded to it earlier. How difficult is it in the face of inequity, of income inequality, for an individual to not just escape poverty, but not to slide back into it?
Well, the data show that among people who are raised in the bottom fifth of the income distribution, that bottom 20%, 70% of them remain below the middle as adults themselves, and only 4% make it all the way to the top fifth. And similarly, we do see some sliding back, especially from the middle class. You know, the actual middle of the income distribution, we see about a third of people slide out of the middle. But I think what's really stark about the data that we've uncovered is the relationship between mobility and race. We know that African American families in particular are much more likely to be downwardly mobile than white families. And in fact, African American adults who are raised in solidly middle income homes, about more than half of them fall out of the middle as adults, compared to only about a third of whites. This actually speaks a lot to the other topic of conversation, which is neighborhood poverty. Research that our project has released shows that children growing up in high poverty neighborhoods explains between a quarter and a third of that black-white mobility gap and downward mobility. So just speaking to the environment, the fact that environment really does matter, and that there are pervasive differences in terms of demographics in the United States and how people experience mobility, and neighborhoods are capturing a lot of that as well.
Linwood, if the research shows that economic mobility is so challenging and limited, why do you think the American story of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps continues to be such an enduring idea?
I think it appeals. I don't know. I'll just say I look at that question a lot, and I've been working on that issue recently. It must appeal to a sense of or a piece about Western cultural heritage, which is around individualism and around merit, and you know the fact that we are a nation of immigrants, meaning that in one sense, many of the people who came here to pursue opportunities, often pulling themselves up, so to speak, by their bootstraps, that we've married ourselves to that narrative, and we won't let it go despite the fact that it just doesn't hold up over time, that you can look at a number of texts on white privilege, on white affirmative action as against or as in contrast to affirmative action for African Americans and other groups. And you find that all Americans have benefited from community, from relationships, from the government, and that corporations equally have benefited as well from what in fact is the way we transact business in this nation, as opposed to what we believe, and that is that we pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. So, to get back to the point, I think there's something about us culturally that has left us married to this notion of individualism and merit, and we need to get beyond that.
If I could just jump in, I completely agree, and I also think a piece of what may be happening is...
In just about 20 seconds, Erin.
Okay, rates of absolute mobility, that families do have higher incomes than their parents, so even if they're stuck at the bottom, they can point to income growth that they've experienced, and that makes them feel like they're closer to achieving the American dream.
Erin Currier is the director of the Economic Mobility Project at Pew Charitable Trusts, and Linwood Cousins is director and professor at the School of Social Work at Western Michigan University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, does privilege and inequity affect policy? Who's at the table when policy is being discussed and designed? Call us. Join the conversation, 866-255-2762, or drop us a question on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. I'm Jennifer White, and you're listening to State of Opportunity here on Michigan Radio. This hour, we've been exploring the issues of inequity and privilege. Now we want to focus the lens on policy. When policies are being designed, when policy agendas are being created, do privilege and inequity come into play? We're joined now by David Callahan, co-creator of the think tank Demos, and State Representative Rashida Tlaib, who represents the 6th District of Southwest Detroit. David, Representative, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thank you for having me.
David, I want to start with you. You're co-author of a report called Stacked Deck, and you looked at the intersection of politics and money. How did that relationship impact economic mobility?
Well, what we found in the report is things that are familiar to many people, which is that wealthy Americans vote at much higher rates. They're more likely to contact their representatives. They're more likely, of course, to give money to politicians. The donor class is made up primarily of people who are quite well off financially. And these people have a much larger voice in public policy and public policy outcomes. And as a result, policies that help ordinary Americans climb up the economic ladder often don't get as far in our political process as they might if we had a more representative democracy, because affluent Americans don't necessarily prioritize things like Pell Grants for poor kids, or the Earned Income Tax Credit, or raising the minimum wage, and often actively oppose those kinds of policies.
Representative Tlaib, you represent a district that has some concentrated poverty. As a lawmaker, do you find it difficult to advocate for the people you represent to make sure their concerns are part of the policy discussion?
Absolutely. I agree with David in discussing the fact that there is such inequality when it comes to the weight of the voices of those that live in poverty and those that don't. And it is very difficult because their voices are drowned by people that have money that can hire so-called lobbyists or be part of special interest groups. And yes, their priorities are extremely different from those that are in poorer communities that want to focus on quality education for their children, focusing on tax relief, like the Earned Income Tax Credit provided for those that lived in poverty.
This idea of America as an egalitarian place where everyone has a shot at success, it continues to prevail to some degree. But according to the Demos report, David, that's not reflected in our public policy. Expand a bit on why that is. Where is the breakdown?
Well, a big problem or a big finding of our report is that, we all know that the wealthy are more likely to give money to politicians and more likely to vote. What our report, though, did is shine light on another very important fact, which is that the wealthy often have different public policy preferences than ordinary Americans. So it's not only that they have more power in the political process, but they want different things. So, for example, raising the minimum wage is overwhelmingly backed by a majority of the public. The wealthy are not so keen on it because many of them have businesses. Support for higher education, ensuring that anybody who wants to go to college can afford to do so with government assistance, is overwhelmingly popular among Americans. It's less popular among the wealthy. So, when you have this affluent class with so much clout in our political system, and they have different views than what many ordinary Americans want, that creates some outcomes that are not so great in terms of helping people get up the economic ladder.
You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. Give us a call, 866-255-2762. Have you experienced a shift in income or wealth that changed the way you think about policies that affect low-income families? You can also send us a comment on the State of Opportunity Facebook page or tweet us at State of Op, that's with two P's. David, is this dynamic apparent at every level of government, federal, state, and municipal?
You could see this play out in different places. Certainly you can see it play out at the state level, and certainly you can see it playing out in Michigan. I mean, you know, just look at somebody like the Governor Snyder, who is, you know, a business executive, former venture capitalist, worth $200 million, a guy who, you know, spent $6 million on his own campaign and is so wealthy that he takes a dollar a year in salary. Well, you know, most Americans could not afford to work for free. So somebody like that has may have a very different mindset in terms of how to ensure opportunity than, say, your average working person.
So, Representative, as a lawmaker, do you find yourself trying to start policy discussions that aren't necessarily on the radar of other policymakers?
You know, one of the problems in watching our state and the state of Michigan become even poorer is to see the shift on priorities, and is just like David said, because those that are wealthier or well off have different kind of priorities or goals. And today there is more tax relief in the state of Michigan under Governor Snyder's leadership for corporations versus Michigan residents. Today, as we speak, as people are filing their Michigan income tax returns, they're noticing a few hundred dollars missing from the refund. Instead of it going up, it's going down because the tax burden is now on Michigan families versus corporations. We see the fight in Lansing right now in trying to fight for paid sick days. And you see the Michigan Restaurant Association, people that own businesses with, you know, a few hundred employees fighting to prevent paid sick days and prevent opportunities for fair collective bargaining. And we see the fight even with income tax credit, which in many, many communities has been the most successful anti-poverty programs in the nation, is the Earned Income Tax Credit. And that has been completely eliminated. So the shift has been done in regards to how we are trying to address the issues with Michigan families. But one of the key areas that I believe that needs to have a microscope on is education. In poorer communities and neighborhoods, especially in my backyard, I see more crowded classrooms, children without books. You know, there's experiments going on right now with our school district and creating these alternative school districts that may or may not be held accountable to parents that might be concerned about those lack of resources. And so there's a lot of debate in Lansing that's being drowned by folks that do have resources and money and can hire lobbyists, where that senior citizen or that family of four that is struggling every single check, every single disability check, are struggling every single day to pay their bills, struggling every single day to even have the strength to pick up the phone and call me and say, fight harder, get us the resources we need. This is getting out of control. So it's a very difficult situation for many folks like myself that was elected in communities that are struggling so much.
David, I found it interesting in the report. You looked at whether it mattered which political party was in power. What did you find?
Well, in general, the incomes for ordinary Americans have grown faster under Democratic presidents than Republican presidents over the past 50 years. That's a finding of Larry Bartels, who's one of the leading political scientists in the nation, who we draw on his research in our report. I do want to come back to this question of you know, who's at the table. I think that the debate over the minimum wage, you know, the president has called for raising the minimum wage, and that's now, you know, before Congress. What we've seen in the minimum wage fight again and again is that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is one of the biggest spenders on lobbying in the Capitol, is very vigorously opposed to the minimum wage, any increases in the minimum wage. And meanwhile, those people who groups who want the minimum wage to go up tend to, you know, groups that advocate for the working poor, labor unions tend to have far fewer resources to deploy in the political system, which is one reason why our minimum wage has lagged so far behind over the past 30 years.
I wanted to bring someone into the conversation, but it sounds like we just lost the call. But I will ask the question anyway. The question was whether or not, if the people who are not being represented were better organized, would that make a difference? David, I'll ask you first, and I also want your feedback, Representative.
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, if people get organized, they can affect change. The problem is that our political system keeps tilting more and more in the favor of big money, you know, especially after the Citizens United decision. So a single donor in the 2012 election cycle, Sheldon Adelson, gave more money than the residents of 12 U.S. states put together. Well, you know, if you have one guy who has as big of a voice in our political system than the residents of 12 entire states, I mean, that just shows you how stacked the deck really is.
Representative Tlaib, what do you hear from your constituents? Are they able to be involved in these discussions, or are their day-to-day lives just, it's too much right now for them to try to worry about what's happening in Lansing?
You know, sometimes it is too much, but one big success in showing the power of the one vote, because that's one thing that they cannot replace. No amount of money can replace that one vote, because if you are a rich voter or a poor voter, that vote is weighed the same way. And when residents were pushing for environmental justice issue in Southwest Detroit, yes, I had to get more partners and people to help me transport, you know, provide transportation for them to get to Lansing. But even when they got there, it was trying to empower them that they did have a voice. And just because, you know, folks there that had suits and ties on and, you know, looked a little different, that they would not be heard. But they were so surprised to see the power that they had as soon as they spoke into the microphone in the committee hearing, and how receptive people were to see the tens and thousands of people that did end up showing up because we provided access to transport, because we said this had to be done, because it's a partnership. When I go out there and fight for the residents I represent, it's not as powerful as if 10 or 15 of my residents are next to me and they're as loud as I am about why there's such injustice in our education system, why that polluting industry has to be next to our poor neighborhoods versus areas where there isn't homes. And so there is a struggle, though, in empowering residents that are finding or feeling demoralized, feeling defeated, feeling that their voice might be not heard because of the fact of their class.
David, when we talk about the policies that are being enacted, are the middle class benefiting from those policies? Or is this something that's limited to just low-income families? Or are people who are not wealthy being negatively impacted by policies that are going into place?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think a great example is the cuts to higher education that have been taking place in states across the country, including in Michigan, which has sharply cut funding for higher education. And, you know, the as tuition goes up for public universities, a lot of middle-class families find themselves struggling to pay and end up, kids end up going into debt to pay for public universities that used to be, you know, practically free a generation ago. And so you have, I mean, the higher education has traditionally been a really important path into the middle class. And as those cuts are made, it becomes a more difficult path to travel. Meanwhile, in many places, including Michigan, we've seen very large tax breaks to corporations, even as these higher ed cuts are happening, and that suggests, you know, priorities which are really out of whack with what most middle-class people might want.
Representative Tlaib, your constituents, they are families who live below the poverty line, families that are on the economic bubble. We're talking about kids who can't vote but who live in poverty. What does all of this mean for them from your viewpoint as a lawmaker?
You know, one of the first things that comes out of my mouth in a committee when we're fighting for more funding for education, because we've had some of the largest cuts, not only to higher education, but K through 12. We've seen such defunding of education in Michigan that it's causing tremendous, what I call, potholes in our education system that's going to push people more back into poverty. And these children don't have what we call, you know, special interest groups or lobbyists out there fighting for them. What this is going to mean, it's going to be harder for us to help children that are living in poverty. And I can tell you, as a person has lived in poverty, you know, being the eldest of 14, child of immigrants, I lived in a poor neighborhood, struggled day to day in regards to trying to figure out how we were going to survive. And it was education and access to quality education and the investment that was being done to education from K through 12 and even making it affordable. Especially, I was a product of Pell Grants. And I don't think any success story you've heard out there of somebody that lived or came from a poor community or came from a poor family, their success is always based on their access to education, quality education. And those children are going to pay the price. And the biggest unfunded liability that Michigan can ever create is a generation of undereducated children. And when you see the rate of folks in correction systems, 70% of those in corrections right now are high school dropouts. If that's not telling of the fact that folks that are wealthier, folks that are middle class, if they don't think that this is going to impact them in the long run, it will, because guess who's going to have to pay for it? We all will have to pay for all of those increases in corrections budgeting and some of the other issues that go with it. So I absolutely think that it is critical that we prioritize our budget in the state of Michigan, where we focus primarily on fixing the broken education system that we have in the state of Michigan. And I believe that could be the best way in getting folks out of poverty.
David, we've got just about 20 seconds. Is there a 20-second answer to how we balance out these policy priorities?
Well, an important thing to do in broad strokes is get big money out of the political process and get more little people in. You know, if we had a political process where more people voted, everyone participated, and fewer big donors had such clout, I think that we would get a set of public policies that were more favorable to the middle class.
David Callahan is co-creator of the think tank Demos, and Rashida Tlaib is a Democrat representing Michigan's 6th District in the State House. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. You can continue to share your thoughts with us on Facebook. Just search for State of Opportunity or tweet us at State of Op. And if you have a story to share about what it's been like to grow up or raise kids in Michigan while struggling to pay the bills, we want to hear from you. Be a resource for this project by going to the State of Opportunity website. Click on the Share Your Story link. State of Opportunity was produced and directed by Zoe Clark, engineered by Bob Scon. We had assistance from Sarah Alvarez, Kimberly Springer, Bridget Nile, and Allie Billings. Tamar Charney is the executive producer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jen White.